Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a couple of guests who are on the front line of sort of doing research and exploring the whole concept of personalized medicine with a particular focus on cancers. We have in the studio with us the Dean of the College of Science, Dr. Rob Kirkin from the Biological Sciences Department, and then a physician, Dr. Benjamin Carcamo from Texas Tech Medical Facility, the Paul Foster Medical Facility here in El Paso. Gentlemen, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith.
Now, we've all heard and we've all read in the newspapers and all sorts of things like this that personalized medicine is the way to go. You know, you get your genome taken and they know every little thing about you and they can treat every possible disease you're ever going to get on a personal basis. We're a long way from that. But we're going to talk a little bit about that today with the collaboration between someone on the front line of medicine and someone on the front line of basic research. So, Rob, let me start with you. Because it's not usual in a university without a long record to get this sort of nice research and real-life medical collaboration. How did it come about?
No, that's a great question, Keith. So it really began many years ago for me, of course, from my early days at the National Cancer Institute. And much of my early research then was looking at what we'd call these signal transduction pathways, which is really the networks within the cell that allow for this communication to occur. So there's, of course, thousands and thousands of little pathways that tell a cell to live, to die, to grow. And so from our research, we've always been interested in trying to understand those pathways when they're turned on and functioning normally and when they're turned off and when they're functioning normally. And, of course, in the case of cancer, you have this essential on signal all the time that's telling them to grow when they shouldn't be. And so for much of our research, it's been about trying to identify drugs and other molecules that can perhaps turn those pathways off that should be off. So we've continued to do that work for many years. But mostly what we've done is used cell lines and tissue, which is perhaps cancer-derived cells that were isolated many, many, many years ago. And I think what happened here in El Paso is that we were able to generate a partnership and collaboration with Dr. Carcamo and be able to look at some of these what we call primary tumors or fresh tumors that were recently isolated from a patient
Patients will still be alive.
And the patients are right. Still alive. And it would be part of their normal visit, right? They would come in. They would have blood drawn, for example. A sample would be sent off to the pathologist. But perhaps a small amount of that sample could actually be sent to us after the patient is consented or what we'd call de-identified. Right. And then we could do those kinds of tests looking at those signaling pathways to try to figure out what's going wrong in that cell.
And they all go to the Department of Biological Sciences. You avoid having any of those tissues come to chemistry, I hope. Dr. Carcamo, let's look at your point of view. You're a practicing physician.
Pediatric oncologist.
A pediatric oncologist, which means you're basically treating young children who've got cancer.
Exactly.
Perhaps one of the most horrible sort of concepts, but I mean, young children, you just don't want them to suffer, right? Mm. So you then will have a patient come and they'll find that there's a cancer of some particular part of the body. And then there's a regular process that you go through. There's a regular set of treatments that you will resort to on that particular patient based upon the literature. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about here is something that at the end of those normal treatments, it's been ineffective. You just have not been able to arrest the growth of the cancer. Would that be about where I'm heading? That's about what you're doing?
Yes, that's a way that we it has been working. Usually when the patient arrives and, we are making the initial diagnosis, usually a sample is taken. Okay, if the patient has leukemia, the sample usually comes from the bone marrow or sometimes the blood. If the tumor, if there is a solid tumor, then usually the tumor will have to come out. Okay. And once that tumor comes out, and that's something that has to be done on most of the patients, okay, if possible, the tumor has to come out. Then we look at the tumor and try to decide what kind of tumor it is and put a name to it. We make a diagnosis basically based on the tissue that is provided to the pathologist. And then that information is used so to treat patients with standard treatments. Now, when we collect a sample and the pathologist evaluates the tumor, and when he's finished with his work, okay, usually that tumor is disposed of. Okay, we don't keep it. We don't save it for the rest of our lives. Okay, I mean, the tumor is usually disposed, and that's it. Okay, But what has happened...
Incinerated, just as a matter of interest, or they just put it in the garbage?
I'm sure that, you know, I don't know how it's disposed. Okay, right. The hospitals have their own protocols where they dispose of these biological tissues. What is happening now is that usually that is from, it's information that is wasted, okay, because there is a lot to learn from every single tumor. Because of the partnership with Dr. Kerkening, we have been able to provide tissues that otherwise would be destroyed, okay? And now they are being used to learn more about pediatric cancer, and not only pediatric cancer, I'm sure that other type of cancer are being evaluated.
So that's the first stage then. It's the pathologist who has to make the identification. So
exactly.
He's a key person in this team.
Exactly.
All right? And then you will pass over the other person will pass it to Rob. And Rob, what do you do when you get this sample?
Right, and I think that's a key point. So Dr. Harry Wilson's been really key, I think, to this whole process. He's been the pathologist that we've been working with. And essentially, we, of course, as you know, Keith, we have some incredible technology at UTEP. There's been a significant investment here in the university in this type of equipment, which really allows us to take very, very small samples of this tissue and be able to run literally tens, if not hundreds of tests on that. And essentially what we're trying to do is map those communication pathways in those cells and try to determine, again, which drugs that may not be specifically approved for that cancer may actually work within that cancer.
Yeah, I think that's a key point because as we learned just now from Ben, that there's a protocol when you've got a cancer. There's certain treatments which are recognized internationally, nationally, regionally, wherever, how to treat that cancer. But then if the patient is not recovering or there's no evidence of remediation, then you've come to the end of your treatments. And
exactly.
That's when perhaps this personalized and extra investigation becomes really important.
Well, I think that's what we're doing now. And I think, as Dr. Carcamon said, you know, the front line, there's always the primary and the secondary treatment options, and he follows all those to a T. I think it's at that point where you've tried everything and nothing really has seemed to work, then what? And I think what we try to do is by looking at those pathways and trying to study those particular cancer cells, take a little bit of the guessing out of which therapy may potentially work. And I think that's really the strength of some of the tools and the technology that we use, that we can say probably you would never be able to predict that this drug or that drug would
right.
actually work on that tumor.
That's so-called offline drugs.
Or off-target,
off
exactly,
target.
Off-label. And this is where it's really been effective, I think, in identifying some compounds that would normally you wouldn't expect to work. And I think the key behind that, as I'll just add, is that it's part of it's because you don't often know which of these pathways or these signals within these cells are turned on. And these drugs are never quite as specific as you think or hope they would be. They often target many, many different pathways.
Yeah, even alcohol is not specific. many side issues with alcohol. Let's just go back, though. When you get the sample, Rob, all right, I mean, are you then reproducing that cell line to study in many experiments, or is it all just with a particular tissue sample that you get?
Right. We try to do all the treatments as we can, all the tests within that first sample set. So we don't often – we do keep some samples which we freeze away, but mostly we want that sample to be as fresh as possible and as it's – normal state when it comes through the door. So at that point, we try to do as many of the tests we can immediately, and then we pool all that data together, and that's when we essentially turn a lot of that information over to Dr. Carcamo and provide for him and his staff information that he may use in his treatment protocol.
Well, one final question before we come back to Ben. Rob, so the aging of the tissue is an issue. I mean, just because you've got a tissue that's a day old, that can have different sort of transmission informational pathways than something that's been around for a week or two or a month or two.
I think that's an excellent point, Keith, because much of what we're doing is not looking at the genetics. Much of the genetics is done there in the, you know, by the pathologist initially in those tests. What we're looking at is the proteins. We're looking at the things in the cell that are actually doing the work. And I think this is the big difference. The genetic component is critical for all of the information that's going to be that's going to result in that particular cell. But what really does the work and what really can cause the problem is the proteins.
That's the messengers.
That's the messengers. Yeah. And the longer those cells sit around, the more those messengers start to decay, and it's very difficult to get a good information once those samples have sat, even for just a few hours at room temperature.
So, Ben, coming back to you then, mm-hmm. when you hear Rob talking about the proteins being the key features and what do you think? Did you know this originally? Was this part of your medical training? Or are you thinking, oh, this is an interesting new way to tackle a problem?
Well, actually, it's something that we have learned over the years, okay? It's something that we are actually learning in the medical community. You know, I've been around for a long, long time, so I have gone from the moment that, you know, we knew so very little about these diseases and to the point that we have evolved to learn the role of the genes and to learn the role of the proteins. But I think that it's now just recently in the last few years, okay, that really this is making such a difference for the treatment of pediatric cancer. In the past, cancer had a dismal prognosis. I mean, just everybody was dying, and children were not doing any better than adults, okay? Everybody was dying. And we are talking about 40, 50 years ago when, you know, we started really making an impact on the survival of cancer. And then we learn about these little things, about radiation, about chemotherapy, about, you know, the role of different surgical approaches, and survival has improved. Year by year, you know, we have improved. So actually, pediatric protocols have been so successful, okay, and they have been very standardized. And they have been so successful that we have reached to a point that we are curing most of the kids. However, about 15% of the kids, 15 to 20% of the kids still fail. And they fail that all this therapy that we have available. And, we have gone to a crossroads, okay, where, there are no new chemotherapy agents that are being discovered.
Okay? Well, there are an awful lot of people, I would say. I've just come back from the American Chemical Society meeting. Yeah, but it seems every other paper, someone's trying to make something
exactly,
and test it.
But we don't see much of a difference. Okay,
no.
I think that we have gone as far as we were going to go with a standard treatment, with chemotherapy, with radiation, with a surgical approach. I think that we have reached a crossroads, okay? And I think that biological therapy is what is going to make the real difference in the next decade or so. And that's where that we have learned over the last 10 years. We learned it with chronic myelogenous leukemia when they discovered the BCR-ABL and discovered Gleevec, for example. It's a medication that is blocking this gene, okay? And it's blocking this gene so that gene won't be producing this protein that will be telling the leukemia.
Let me ask a question there because, you know, it's the same with bacteria. Someone says, we've got this wonderful bactericide, biocide. Just wipes these bacteria away. Mm. But bacteria are clever. You know, they find another way. They found another way to sort of survive. Mm. Now, when you're sort of talking about stopping a genetic step or you're interfering with the activation of a particular gene, does the body, does the cancer cells at some stage have a way to get around that too?
And they do.
It's not a battle that we can see a victory. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a constant. Just as it was with bactericides.
Exactly. And I can see an application right there because for example, with chronic myelogenous leukemia, we know that this medication will work for many years, but at one point some people will become resistant to it.
Yeah.
And then they will need to be changed to a different medication. Now, the decision on how to make that change is based only on basically, it's an arbitrary choice. It's based on studies that have shown that this medication may work in this situation, okay, and has worked in this situation. Yeah. Okay, we're going to try it.
So we have to take a break here. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dr. Ben Carcamo from the El Paso Children's Hospital, part of the Texas Tech Medical Facility here in El Paso, Texas, and Dr. Rob Kirkin, who is the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Texas at El Paso, my immediate boss, I suppose.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. It may be obvious that we need a reliable agency to vet the drugs that come onto the market, but the point is glaring when you revisit a case like the thalidomide disaster in Europe.
In 1957, thalidomide was a mild, over-the-counter sleeping pill, supposedly safe for pregnant women that also reduced morning sickness. The German company Chemie Grünenthal aggressively marketed the drug in 46 countries, even though the wife of an employee who took the drug before its release gave birth to a child with no ears.
Within 2 years, as many as 1 million West Germans were taking the drug daily as thousands of babies with severely malformed limbs were being born.
Though approved in Europe, thalidomide had far less impact in the U.S. thanks to Frances Oldham Kelsey with the Food and Drug Administration. She denied the drug a U.S. license because of insufficient clinical evidence about its side effects.
It wasn't long before adults began reporting symptoms of nervous system damage. Then, two doctors independently linked thalidomide to birth defects in 1961, but it took the company 4 months to pull the drug.
Health officials believe the drug caused more than 90,000 miscarriages, over 10,000 birth defects, and 40% of exposed babies died before or soon after delivery.
The thalidomide tragedy prompted major reforms in Europe and serves as a powerful reminder of the importance of drug regulations.
As for Dr. Kelsey, who largely kept the drug out of the U.S., President Kennedy awarded her the President's Medal for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service, the highest civilian honor.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Dr. Rob Kirkin, Dean of the College of Science and a bioscientist, and Dr. Ben Carcamo from the El Paso Children's Hospital of Texas Tech Medical Facility in El Paso, Texas. Okay, so at the end of that first segment, we got to the point where, you know, you've learned how these proteins now can be a good target to sort of stop the communication within the cell. When did you, Ben, Dr. Carcamo, see a possibility of the interaction with Rob?
Well, actually, it was through Dr. Harry Wilson.
That's the pathologist we're talking about.
Okay. He had already started a collaboration with Dr. Kirkin and was supplying a tissue that was would otherwise been discarded to him for these studies. Dr. Kirkin was learning about these pathways and then realized that this had an application for pediatric cancer, for cancer in general, actually. He has been able to identify different pathways that had non-drugs that could be used to block them. And then Dr. Wilson approached me and told him, Dr. Kirkin is doing this great work with these biological pathways, and maybe this is something that we can use, especially on these patients where everything has failed. And unfortunately, we get into this situation more often than we want.
Tell us about a big success story. Yes. I mean, we don't want to make this too dismal a program because there is some hope. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
Give us a story, obviously anonymous names, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, most recently we had a child that had a tumor in the brain, something that we call a supratentorial PNET, a very, very bad tumor. That is bad in adults, but it's even worse in children. The survival is very, very poor. Usually these children already present with tumors that are too large to be removed, and many times they come with tumors that have already spread. And the survival, at best, is 20-30% for those tumors that are not resected. When they are resected, we may reach 50%, a little bit more. But that's the best, okay? The worst happens whenever they are diagnosed when they are very, very little. Okay, because one of the elements of the treatment, the standard treatment, besides chemotherapy and surgery, is radiation. And it's a very important part of the treatment. And but if the children are diagnosed when they are very young, less than 3 years of age, the brain still is developing, and radiation will stop that development of the brain. Okay, will have significant impact on intellectual.
Is that a factor with cancers in children versus adults in general?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the child is rapidly growing, rapidly developing, so all treatments that are going for the cancer cells are going to have a negative impact on healthy cells.
Exactly, and we have to pay attention to that because we want the child to survive, but we also want a child that is going to have a productive life, okay? What we have done for this kind of tumors is try to use different approaches to try to delay the moment that we are going to have to give radiation. The longer that we delay it, the more that the child is going to grow. And usually we try to delay it until they are 3 years of age. Okay, this particular kid was diagnosed when she was only 30 months of life. Okay, wow. So she was 30 months. She had this terrible disease, and we started treatment with the standard treatment, which was surgery, if possible, which was not possible in this particular case, and chemotherapy. Okay, and we used the standard chemotherapy with standard protocols, and the tumor continued to grow. The next evaluation which we did, the tumor was bigger, okay? And we basically felt that this child was going to die, okay? I mean, we felt that she was going to die very, very soon. So we went back to Dr. Kerken, and we told them, with the permission of the parents, if they could provide to us the information that he had learned on this tumor. And he was able to tell us that, yes, this tumor has a pathway that is very active, and there is a drug that we can use to block it, okay? So we started this child in this particular medication.
Now, this was a medication, I'm switching to Rob for a minute, this was a medication that was on the books but for a totally different reason.
Exactly. So for us, our typical protocol would be to take a variety of these drugs and then simply just test them. And one of those drugs that came out was very effective in slowing the growth of this particular tumor.
And do you remember the drug and what was it
this
initially
one was dasatinib. Yes,
dasatinib
was the name of the drug. And of course, you know, much of this work was done by Dr. Jeremy Ross in the laboratory, who was critically involved in this process. And basically what he did was to look at those pathways, look at the responsiveness, and then use a lot of additional tests to see if this drug was effective in turning off the pathways that Dr. Carcamone mentioned.
Well, what's the drug originally designed for?
Well, it's for a family of what we call tyrosine kinases, so but it has many different targets and many different effects. So, but again, as we said at the beginning, you never know what you're going to see until you actually try this.
Okay.
And we found that within this particular
So when Rob finds then that this particular offline drug was very useful, how do you go about administering it? How much you know how much to administer?
Well,
I mean, that's a whole game there by itself.
Yeah, but actually, many of these drugs are already being, actually, they are FDA-approved drugs. Okay,
right.
This particular drug has been used like one of those drugs that we use when the medication we use for chronic myelogenous leukemia fails. Then we use this medication, dasatinib.
Okay, so it has been used in some form of cancers before.
Yeah, it's been used for other cancers.
Right.
Okay, and there are other uses that have been, you know, not only for chronic myelogenous leukemia, has also been used for other type of leukemias, mostly leukemias, but there are some solid tumors that have been used for.
So you already had a knowledge of how much
exactly,
to give.
We already know we already know that the toxicity of the drug. Okay, we already know and that's that is safe. We already know the side effects, what to look for, and we already know the dose that has to be used for on a child so it will be effective, okay? So basically, we just use a drug that is known for for a disease that has never been used for before.
And so the outcome in this case?
The tumor stopped growing, okay, which was amazing by itself, okay? And not only that, it started getting smaller. And that was, to me, it was like seeing a miracle. I never expected that because I thought that when I saw those MRIs, I thought that this girl was dead, period. And now she has grown, and she's about, probably right now, she's about 43 months of life, which is very good because the brain has had a lot of chance to grow and to mature. She was able to have a successful surgery, and that she doesn't have that tumor anymore. And she will go on to receive radiation. And now I think that she has a very good chance of surviving.
Okay, that's good.
I don't know if it's going to happen, but I believe that.
So you're not in that position to sort of think.
No, because
it's
just happening just right now. Okay?
Right.
You asked me for a recent success, and to me that's an amazing success. Okay, and this child had no hope, and now she has hope. Yeah.
On a slightly different, very academic question, you've made a quite astounding discovery between the two of you, or the three of you, or the four of you. Do you publish this? How do you get that knowledge out to the rest of the community in medicine and research?
No, that's a great point, Keith, because I think at the end of the day, we want everybody to learn from this research, yeah. and especially when we have such positive outcomes. So we do. We do publish this, and this particular study we've already submitted to a major national cancer conference, right. With Dr. Hartman taking the lead there. And these are the type of studies that we want the rest of the medical community to see, that this may be a viable treatment option to consider down the road. And I think as Dr. Carcamo and I were speaking, that while it's not the frontline treatment today, maybe in the future with additional clinical trials, maybe it will be someday. But clearly it represents another option that wasn't previously considered.
Yeah, but beyond the success, there's also the story that says to people and teams, nascent teams that hadn't even formed, Albuquerque, Salt Lake City, I don't know, you name the place, where you've got a facility with your good equipment, right, and that high-level research universities have this, and a medical school, that there should be much more of this interaction, because it seems to me so incredibly promising.
No, I think that's a great point, and I think this is where the partnership has really paid off, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have our group, and of course we have many undergraduate and graduate students that are doing this research.
Yeah.
Partnering with a very active clinician that wants to see this type of research being conducted and can put it into practice. So I think these types of partnerships are not as free-flowing as we'd like them to be.
Right.
And I think that's what makes it really unique about what we're doing here in El Paso.
So there are two things you have to have. You have to have permission of, in this case, the parents of,
exactly.
of the patient. And you also presumably have to have some permission to use a drug that's sort of been designed for disease A to be used in your study, or no? Not your study, in your treatment.
When we are using this medication, we are using medication that are FDA approved, okay, and they are already being used for other type of situations. Right now, we are not using as a front therapy, okay? We are using it at the point of treatment of cancer when everything has been used, okay? And in this situation, people can use this kind of drugs, okay? Basically, FDA drug used for other diseases, you can use it for something that you think that it may work, okay? But always with the permission of the parents. Now, if we want to go and introduce this medication to frontline therapies, okay, and then we're going to have to go through a process, okay,
right.
to be able to do the research for that.
And I think it's important to add, Keith.
And that will happen. I think that's going to happen. And, you know, I was telling Dr. Kirkin that I was just recently in Houston for a Texas Brain Consortium. We are trying to get together the oncologists, the pediatric oncologists that are working with brain tumors here in Texas to work as a group or try to
right.
develop protocols, new protocols that will be Texan born to attack pediatric brain tumors.
Rob, you're going to have a comment just there.
No, and I think it's just to make sure it's very clear, as Dr. Carcamo mentioned, these are all FDA-approved drugs that we're
right,
testing,
yeah.
so this isn't something that was generated
no,
in the laboratory.
No, you're not going into the kitchen and finding
no,
some
these are,
spice
exactly.
from the
so
Orient.
These have been, of course, rigorously tested and approved, and so we're not using anything off the shelf. This is
well, they're off-the-shelf drugs. Where do you get them all from? I mean, you must have a suite. I shall come over and visit. All right, I got all sorts of... Paranoid. What's the word? Hypochondria. I'm a sort of hypochondriac. We've come to the end of a really interesting program. There's so many more things I'd like to talk about, and I hope, Ben Carcamo, that you can come back and talk to us again about this area and your collaboration with Rob and the University of Texas at El Paso. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Keith.
And thank you very much, Dr. Ben Carcamo from the El Paso Children's Hospital associated with the Texas Tech Medical Facility in El Paso, Texas, and Rob Kirkin, Dean of College of Science at the University of Texas at El Paso. And beyond and above both those wonderful guests, I must thank Norma Martinez that puts the program together, smiles through the mistakes, corrects the mistakes. She's won therapeutic treatment right there. Thank you very much, Norma, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The medical staff at Sierra Providence Health Network has teamed up with researchers from the University of Texas at El Paso. The collaboration agreement was initiated about 6 months ago. The purpose is to further clinical research and scientific medical research in El Paso. Read more in the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.